When you sit at a dinner table, you don't really think about where your food came. But every meal has a story. The problem is, most of us never really hear it. For generations, North American agriculture has operated on a simple principle. We grow it, we ship it, and we make the money and cash the check. But now, in grocery stores, crowded with endless options, that model is starting to crack. What happens when a farmer leaves the fields for New York's fashion industry, only to return with a marketing vision? That transforms how we connect food to consumers. That's the journey that's reshaping modern agriculture.
I want to bridge the gap between like food on a plate and food in a restaurant and how it's grown, and just kind of create more connection and awareness around that.
In this episode, I get to sit down with Ali Cox. She is the founder of Noble West. It's a marketing agency that brings entertainment industry storytelling to a place that's a bit unexpected, which is agriculture. As a former Olympian, and she's a fifth-generation farmer who spent about a decade working in New York's creative industries, she's uniquely positioned at the intersection of farming tradition and modern marketing. From pistachios with celebrity endorsements to rice brands that have multi-generational loyalty, we explore how the most successful agriculture businesses are the ones willing to invest in their stories and not just their yields.
Oftentimes, the work you're doing is already good. You just don't know how to package it up into a story that's usable to the person who's selling your crop.
Welcome to The Capitalist Hippie, the podcast where we challenge the old rules of business to build something better. I'm Marco Pimentel, marketing expert, entrepreneur, and lover of bold, sustainable ideas. Every week, we dive into data-backed insights, groundbreaking ideas, and real-world strategies that help you outthink and outmaneuver the status quo. Today, we're digging into the soil of agriculture marketing to uncover what it really takes to transform commodities into brands that consumers really connect with. Let's get into it. Ali, thank you so much for joining me. I'm excited because we get to kind of nerd out on marketing and we get to talk about storytelling and the importance storytelling and marketing can do for businesses that ultimately are trying to do things that are better for our planet and for our earth, which is amazing. But you are a storyteller and you help people tell their stories with marketing. But before we begin there, like, what brought you into the world of food and agriculture and marketing, and what was that connection?
Well, thanks for having me, Marco. Thrilled to be here. Love this podcast. To answer your question directly, nothing brought me into it because I was already there. We are a fifth generation farming family on both sides of my family. So on my dad's side, more row crops, and we have cattle, and now we have lots of different kind of tree nuts. And then on my mom's side, a traditional produce company. So I personally grew up working in the melons in a big melon company. So I think I've always been here. I don't know anything different. I don't know a summer of a family vacation because we have never taken one. I think that's just part of being a farmer's daughter and now farmer's wife. But I think that my aha professionally was after 10 years in New York deciding, you know what, I really love marketing. I worked at Fashion Week. I worked at sports. I worked at TV, and then just really made a very intentional decision to move back from New York City, back to my hometown. I had thoughts of moving to Sacramento because it's such a big food city in California. And it was really just the note of like, how can I utilize all of my skills that I have in marketing and PR for something I actually care about? I want to bridge the gap between like food on a plate and food in a restaurant and how it's grown, and just kind of create more connection and awareness around that. That was really the goal. Now, what that was 12 years ago, and what has happened in 12 years ago has been incredible. We've grown a ton. We now operate in several states. We have international clients. So it's just really been kind of like bringing that lens of entertainment marketing that I had with also kind of the traditional history of agriculture. And just understanding like what got us here is not going to get us there is something that I bring to the team. And my team is intentionally very diverse because, frankly, the food system is very diverse.
And so when you went to New York, it was kind of like, I don't want to be in the farming space. I've been this my whole life. This is fifth generation. I want to go to the biggest city in the U.S. where all the action is and just get a different life experience and learn from everything that I can learn. But was there ever an intention to come back when you were leaving?
No, no, I was using no. And I used to be a, international rower. I was I'm an Olympian. So I was Olympian in rowing. And so I'd already traveled the world and I trained in Princeton, New Jersey, which is outside of New York. So New York was just a natural step because a lot of my friends from rowing were going there. It's a huge rowing hub. And so just an incredible network was already kind of built there. No, I was ready for like life adventures that I probably would never be able to get in anywhere else. So that wasn't really on the radar. I think that when I turned 35 years old, I kind of had the aha, like I have to now work on things that really matter to me. I don't think I'm alone in that. There's something about like kind of once you've already had 10 or 15 years of working under your belt and you sort of sit back and go, wait a minute, is this like real life now? Like, this is my future. Oh gosh. Like, do I want that? Or do I want to think about how I can do better for the world and better for farmers and better for consumers? And I didn't know what I wanted to accomplish, but I knew I wanted to do something meaningful, and which is something I feel super proud of in our kind of day-to-day work with Noble West.
Yeah. And so when you came back, did you have the idea to start Noble West, or was that just kind of a process that happened once you came back to Central California and back on the farm, back in the area, and back and you started to make that idea? Like, what was your plan when you came back?
I think that when I came back, I'm a natural creative, so I think in color. I think that when I came back, I just knew I wanted to be seeing design and work and creative around food looking something like fashion or something like tech or sports, all three industries I had just kind of graduated from, right? I'm a recovering marketer in all those industries.
Okay, so that creative tension, wanting agriculture to look and feel like other industries, is actually where innovation begins. Disruption rarely starts inside the system. It starts with someone who's seen another world and asks, why not there? Or why not here? The agriculture industry doesn't just need better processes, it needs better imagination.
I knew I wanted to see that, and I just wanted ag and food from an origination standpoint to look different. But I was very intentional that I wanted to kind of take my freelance consulting work and build towards the goal of connecting consumers to food. And it was a little bit fuzzy in the beginning, which, I know you have a lot of entrepreneurs who listen to this podcast and like, I'm raising my hand. I fully am one too. I have five other businesses. I can't stop creating. And I think that that's part of it. And Marco, you can probably relate, but like, it's okay to not know the end goal. Like, it's okay just to sort of have a vision and a feeling that you want to feel and like sort of fuzzy creative vision in your head, because that is how I felt. And now I just kind of pinch myself because, a decade of hard work later, I don't work on anything I don't want to work on. I don't work in any industries I don't have any passion for. And I can see I get choked up every time I go to see our clients, because oftentimes I'm like driving past like farm workers harvesting artichokes and harvesting berries and like the bean harvester, and I'll stop by and like, throw my husband a sandwich like on an almond harvester as I'm like driving to this airport, like all those things, because I get to work in the industry that I care about. And we're working in potatoes and hydroponic herbs and cherries and almonds and walnuts and pistachios, and rice, and it's just and dairy and beef, and it's just like really interesting. And I just hope the same for all of your kind of listeners, that they actually lean into the hard, super hard work that it takes to like make dreams come true.
Yeah. Well, farming is very hard and farming has its challenges. So when you came back and you started to work, what was a farmer traditionally doing? As in, how were they marketing themselves, if any? And what's been kind of some of the changes? Because we have a very, very large food system. You obviously know it incredibly well. Marketing has changed when it comes to just growers, you know, between the different type of certifications, how people are growing. But then at the same time, you got all of the problems with food. You know, there's tons of food waste. Climate change has impacted growing seasons. It's very, very difficult. So like, what was kind of traditional before, and what are people now over the last kind of 10 years that you've been working in there, what have they really been doing to kind of change the messaging and change the strategy so that they can be growers and they can be the incredibly important farmers that we need, but still build really, really great businesses?
All good questions, not an easy answer. What I'll say is, part of my personal point of view, and I kind of preach on this almost every day, is that most farmers in most places, especially in Canada or the United States, where it is heavily regulated, I mean, especially in California, like a conventionally grown piece of anything in California is healthier than anything grown in most other places besides like pockets of Europe. You know what I mean? Like, I really mean that. Now, sure, organic, there's a place for organic and we work a lot in organics. There's a place for regenerative. We work a lot in regenerative. We are definitely leading in upcycling kind of strategies. I love that. And so that's all really, really interesting. But I think the most important thing for farmers to take away is oftentimes the work you're doing is already good. You just don't know how to package it up into a story that's usable to the person who's selling your crop.
Yeah. And is that like the old way was, you're a farmer, somebody takes your product, they do the storytelling, they got the consumer, they do it themselves. And that's a big change now, is that a lot of the larger farmers kind of said, well, maybe we should be just selling straight to consumers. Is like, is that a big part of the shift?
Okay. So I think that if we look at like back, like in history, that's where like you had farmers back in the day that were incredible visionaries from a business perspective. They knew their customers, they knew consumers, they knew their retailers, and knew that that's more of a traditional way of doing it. Like, I'm Joe, I grow tomatoes and I sell to Tom at his store of grocery chains. That was great. Obviously, I think we all know that Joe cared about the product Tom was getting. Tom knew Joe. That's all awesome. Now, what happened was an incredible wave of commoditization in our food system, which then inherently has misalignment fraught with problems. Growers are only compensated based on yield. Retailers will take what are going to try to knock the price down as much as they can. Enter a broker who's going to just bastardize the whole entire situation. And then all of a sudden, the consumer's paying for something they don't really understand. And 15 to 20 different entities have sucked on the price to get it to where it is. And the farmer is just taking whatever price they're given to them.
This commodity trap is exactly why storytelling isn't a luxury for farmers. It's strategic defense. When your product becomes interchangeable, you're competing solely on price and yield. But when you control your narrative, you're competing on identity and values. It's not just marketing, it's reclaiming your position in a very, very important value chain.
That is now where farming at scale is. It's not great. But you do have some farmers who have said, and maybe this is because they're well capitalized. Maybe this is because they have the luxury of owning all their equipment and owning everything, and they inherit everything and the ground is paid for, and they have the luxury of infinite amount of wealth to make some expensive mistakes. There's also that. But there are visionaries who are out there who are said, I want to grow it a certain way. I'm not afraid to pay for marketing and branding. I'm not afraid to listen to other people. And those folks who have a vision for how they want their food to be grown and the story they want to tell consumers are in a totally different place than everybody else. The majority, like the everybody else farmer, and I'm related to a lot of these folks, so I say this like with affection. The job was to grow it and get it on a truck and get it off your property. And then that's it. Wait for the check. And your an assessment or a check off is like charged per bushel or per bundle or per pound. And then it goes to the association. It's the association's job to market it. Those days are totally over. They're done. Now the farmer needs to get the good product on the truck, get it off of their property, get it to the hauler or the processor or the dryer or wherever it's going to be processed. And then they have to understand what their contract looks like. They need to understand what their grower, packer, shipper, or what the brand might need in order to get a top value dollar. Like that all is part of it. But where there have been like breakout stars are when you have farmers who have that branding vision as well. A few of them, like let's just keep it in California because it's easy for me off the top of my head, like Lundberg Rice, their grower. They don't process all of their crop, but that's okay. They use their neighbors to do that. They keep title to their rice. They are investing in food innovation. They are investing in marketing. They are investing in reaching the consumer. Incredible job, right? Another one, The Wonderful Company, Wonderful Pistachio. They had a vision to how they wanted to talk to consumers. The first ag company I've ever seen launching national ads with celebrities about a mostly commoditized crop. So there are breakout stars, but where we are working with a lot of our clients is to say, what you're doing is good enough. It's actually great, but we have to talk about your packaging. We have to talk about your story. We have to talk about how you're reaching your audience. We have to talk about the relationship that you want to have with your retail partners. We need to know how you're differentiated, and we need to know how much you're willing to pull out a private label in order to invest in value add. And then once you get those answers, that's when my team like takes off full speed.
And these, so like the Lundberg example, what size, like did they have a large farming business before, kind of selling in the old traditional way, and somebody within their team said, I have a vision to do this differently? Or did they start like really, really small and just said, you know, let's start doing this? Like, I guess that's the question around farming that I think a lot of people think about. Is it all have to be massive scale? Or do a lot of people start with like a 5 acres and an idea and a vision and then kind of expand from there? Because, you know, obviously this is so dependent on land, but I'm trying to understand like what's the future, what are you kind of future farmers thinking about, right? Like where do people right now and can potentially invest in, and like how can you take a new product to market from a small base?
Mm-hmm. I would say like the Lundberg example is a pretty traditional example. Like great grandparents founded it. They left the Midwest, came out to California where they heard that there might be more water, fertile ground, great soil, founded it and probably did a great job doing it probably more the traditional way. But again, back then the traditional way was probably like putting it in sacks and taking it to San Francisco. And then like people were coming to like buy there, right? Then what I think really happened was there was a son who said, okay, I don't see the future looking great for us if we keep doing it this way. What if we decided to double down on sustainability? What if we decided to double down on our name? What if we decided to spend money in branding and marketing? And I think this is where like more traditional farmers just really get tripped up, is that they think like there's some golden parachute that the other people know, when it's not. But what they do know is they have to spend money in ways they're not used to spending money, in advertising, in creative, in campaign work, in product innovation, in packaging. Like that is expensive as all get out. But if you are willing to sort of have a vision for it and listen to those around you, then it could be very different. Now, I'm not suggesting that every small farmer go do this unless they maybe want to have a regional farmers market kind of way of life, which is, if they do, then great. But I'm sort of talking about food at scale.
Food at scale. Yeah. And businesses. But I guess that was my question is, can you, in agriculture, can you start small and then scale? Could a farmer that has, you know, 5, 10, 100 acres, a really great product, you know, a vision, not as much money, can they start and start to kind of expand? And maybe that's the small market. People love it. They package it differently. They do things differently in the farmer's market, and they kind of keep growing over and over, and all of a sudden calling somebody like yourself to figure out how do you scale this thing kind of beyond. It's always kind of just interesting to see all of these small farms to big farms and where the market is going. So yeah, hard things to solve.
I will answer that question as simply as possible. Probably not. They would be that small farm would be the exception, not the rule. The only way that they would be, and we have worked on these kind of projects before, and I'm going to tell you, they are heartbreaking, if I'm being honest, because $50,000 or $100,000 spend on this is a really, really big deal to them. And it is just, it's a flash in the pan.
So I think this is the reality that most people in food innovation avoid talking about. Small scale farming runs on passion, but it still has to survive inside a system designed for scale. The few who make it work really aren't simply working harder. They've learned to change the rules, which we love on this show. Finding new models, new channels, and new measures of success.
How that could work, and I have modeled this out for a client who we created a Wagyu beef brand for. How that could work is a few ways. You have to have incredible relationships with local restaurants, with local farmers markets. What you have to be out front facing, you have to be willing to be the brand, embrace the brand, embody the brand. You could do that. You could get some contracts like that, and you could create a kind of steady cash. It would be really, really hard because you have two very important jobs. You have to farm it, and then you also have to sell it. But it could work. You could, that'd be like a good like partnership with like, you know, two spouses or something. But it's probably not going to scale, and it's certainly going to be a problem if you have more than one generation. That's where a lot of family farms right now are just struggling. There's just too many kids now. And maybe the quality of life they had as a child because the farm was super profitable, now that it's diluted because there's more and more cousins, and now they're forced to sell. And then they're just selling it to a giant.
And then the giants are just buying it, kind of commoditizing it and almost treating it like a fund, I believe, is what I've been seeing as well, where they'll just buy, you know, hundreds and hundreds of acres every single time, and they keep running it that way.
My husband and I are farm management and harvesting business. We have farming customers who are private equity shops, who are corporate farming, and we might be farming our friend's old piece of property.
Yeah. And they hire companies like yourself to manage the entire farm and do all the leasing and management of all of it. And so back to the, like working with, you know, the Lundberg example or the other example of a pistachio company or almond company that needs to kind of go to market. What's the consumer storytelling right now? And does the fact of how they grow, who they are, how they think about, you know, regenerative, organic sustainability. And I know what you mean about the comment of farmers are often doing enough, because farmers are very, very conscious of their spend. They don't spray what they don't need to spray. They don't do the things that they don't want to do because most of it will cost them money. Like, they do fundamentally care about their land, but they are in a unique position just around costs and things like that. But what is it that's kind of working for consumers, and what's the big kind of movement right now that you're finding with the storytelling? Is it more just that they are storytelling, or is it that it's storytelling plus, you know, something else that's working?
So it's been proven that when you're talking to consumers, the three things they care about the most are availability, taste, and price. A very distant, very, very distant fourth is how it was grown. Either regeneratively or organically or sustainably or upcycled or what it was grown with.
So this hierarchy explains why so many sustainability-driven brands struggle. And one that I just kind of think about all the time when I think about CPG products. Even when the intent is right, the opportunity isn't to ditch sustainability, regenerative farming, it's to weave it into what people already care about. Taste, availability, and price. When sustainability enhances those experiences instead of competing with them, it becomes a genuine business advantage.
But it's on the hand, I think, and I think that's sort of the good thing. Like, it's there. It's probably not going to be your driver. We've seen lots of humongous brands launch sustainability-driven, like, climate-forward messaging pillars, and it typically folds. But that doesn't mean, and I think there's just a lot more work has been, and again, we're talking at scale. But what I've been pleased to see is from an environmental standpoint, that brand might not work, but I think like it can fold into a bigger message, which then means you would continue to source like that. So, and I think part of it is really understanding like a farmer's needs. And oftentimes those needs are a place for their crop. If they're going to grow more sustainably and use less chemicals, they have to do more crop rotation, right? So then who's going to buy that? Are we iterating and innovating to create like food brands and products that will be able to receive that? So for wheat, if you're growing wheat, you definitely have to get something in there to fit for nitrogen, right? So are you going to put a yellow pea? Or are you going to put a lima bean or what, a garbanzo? And then who are you going to sell that to? And are they going to take it from you every other year? I don't know. But that's where if you're a food brand and you really are like intentional, I feel like that's where probably more good could happen. And finding a way to kind of weave that story would probably be more beneficial rather than launching with like a climate forward brand, which those are typically challenger brands and they typically don't work.
Yeah. And have you seen any of the regenerative farming work at scale as well, where... Because that's the idea around maybe regenerative is just difficult a thing to sell to consumers, but the underlying benefits, like you talked about, throwing in a rotating crop and making extra money doing that, you know, maybe having to use less chemicals because your soil now is healthier than it was 5 years ago, and so fundamentally you get a better crop and better taste, like you said, that matters a lot, right? So, are there big large scale farms that are working in regenerative that is, you know, maybe it's not the consumer picture, but it is just better business?
I feel like I'm just sitting here talking about a competitor to one of my biggest clients, but Lemberg again. Lemberg has leaned into this. I'll tell you what they did really right from a portfolio management perspective. The Lemberg brand means something, and now they're starting to add products based on those sustainability product goals. So now there's a regenerative. They've had organic for a while. It's across several different varieties with several different milling types. So I feel like they've done a very good job of folding it in. And there's probably some early adoption happening just because there's so much brand equity. But they're not leading with it, if that makes sense. Like they're not going to market with the regenerative just because, you know, they think it's the right thing to do, because that would have probably failed.
Yeah. And it is, you know, there's the confusion of what is regenerative versus organic. And consumers are probably still just, you know, kind of getting a picture of what organic is. So it's hard to sell regenerative to people. I would get that. But, you know, fundamentally, does that mean that it's a better farm because they're doing it? And obviously, all the research says yes, but you have to get there. You have to have deep pockets to do that. And then how do you do that and sell it for? Because I guess the idea is you ultimately can sell it for more money. Because it's a premium product?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's more expensive to do with everything around. But again, this is where it's so challenging, because as soon as you have a consumer standing in an aisle or toggling online during their online shopping, like confused, like, do I do this regenerative rice or this organic, or which one's better? And then they throw their hands up in the air and go like, ugh, can't win. And then they're just going to go back to what's cheapest. Like, that's where it's sort of like, we cannot guilt this purchase at all. And honestly, I just think the regenerative is the worst word. And I think a lot of consumers think it's like medical. Like, I just don't think it does any justice.
Yeah. I think if it can create a better product, a better taste, ultimately drop the cost because they have to use less chemicals and the soil is healthier in the long run, then that ends up just being kind of the win without it trying to be, you know, selling regenerative, which is really tough. So, and you talk a lot about when you're working with these clients, they're like, you know, we want to do a campaign. We want to, you know, market our farm. We want to tell our story. How do you know if it works? Because everything I spend online, I know exactly to the penny how much money I spent and how much money I made back. I have all my LTV modelings, but the entirety of everything is digital and it tracks everything. How do you know if these campaigns work when we're talking about, you know, a retail store to a restaurant to big, you know, wholesale chains? Like, how do you do that?
I think you got to look at the numbers. I mean, that's why there's more digital analysts and business analysts and BI analysts in the marketing departments than ever before. It's sales. I mean, this morning I spent 2 hours on a pricing call of like discussing like the price of a artichokes bag versus, you know, that's where it's sort of like, do we understand and what will the market bear? And, you know, it becomes economics and pricing. And I definitely think that we are close on like business owners and CEOs understanding that marketing is not just about making things pretty anymore. There is definitely a revenue tie. I've seen that like chief marketing officer is a title that's going like is declining, and it's like for by way of like chief revenue officer, which then incorporates more sales responsibility. So there's just like, I think a shifting of the tide that like we no longer, and you know this from digital marketing, like we no longer do things just because they're cool. We only do things if they're measured. I would never, unless there was like a major PR opportunity that was like very rare and probably funded by like commodity assessed like association dollars and didn't have a sales call to action towards it, I probably would not even recommend buying advertising that we couldn't measure.
Yeah. And so what are, like, when it comes to farming and agriculture, what's a common type of advertising campaign now that you're running? Is this, and obviously this is so subjective to your clients because some ones are going to have a lot more money to spend than others, but, you know, is it TV? Is it display? Is it Meta? Is it YouTube? What's working when it comes to marketing?
What's working is buying advertising where target consumers are and your retail presence is strong. So for us, when we're buying advertising, it's not like we're just like putting campaigns out based on where our consumer insights data is. There's that. But then we're also, I mean, to get a campaign out in fresh produce, for example, we then have to go work with the sales teams who then gets a list from the brokers who understands exactly which grocery stores and exactly which zip codes, exactly which location have the product that we're going to buy advertising for. It's a very concentrated approach that is the only way I feel ethically aligned that I can like look our clients in the eye saying, this is how we're going to help you move the needle.
This somewhat hyper-targeted approach is the difference between sustainable marketing and sustainable business. You're not just throwing ads into the void. You're building a system that connects real products to real people. That's what marketing with purpose actually looks like. Knowing where your product lives, who it serves, and how every dollar supports their relationship.
These are totally new conversations. We're talking our clients out of doing like digital coupons from the grocery store now more than anything else, because we can track the data better and we can help push different levers better. But to answer your question, I think it's all of the above, assuming you know exactly where your customer is and exactly which retailer is and the partnership and how it's displayed and which influencers are in their market and things like that.
Yeah, so it has to be very concentrated, very specific, very kind of detailed and dialed to that specific market. What do you think, you know, just in general, the next kind of 3 to 5 years is for farming? You said you hate the word regenerative, which I agree.
But I believe in regenerative farming. I totally believe in it. I just do not know why we're going, we're leading with that to consumers. That's, I think, my point.
That, oh, I agree. And the whole people not even understanding, like, what's the difference between that and organic? Are they same? Are they different? Is just, there's too much confusion that's too difficult for a consumer to understand. But at the end of the day, the core idea of it is amazing for farmers and what they're doing and what we need to be doing. But from like a climate and sustainability, farmers are dealing with all these problems. Where do you think the next kind of 3 to 5 years is going for agriculture? And what are the things that people should be thinking about or investing in or thinking about maybe, you know, getting themselves into?
I mean, are we going to say the T word or not?
You could say it.
Tariffs, I think, are going to have a lot to do with this. I think it's really going to change. I think our diets are probably going to be adjusting. I would also argue, like with our clients, I always kind of repeat, like, there is absolutely no better opportunity to invest in domestic marketing now. So we should be doubling down on that. I think for years and years, the gravy train has been international and export. And now countries like India and China have figured out how to grow almost everything that we grow anywhere in the United States, for example. Same with Canada. So I think what I hope happens is expenses start to steady a little bit for farmers. It's woefully all over the place. I hope that happens. And then what I would say from a trend perspective is I really just want to make sure that we are honestly telling our story and honestly like reaching consumers in a place where it matters to them.
The way that I see it is that farming has always been about growth. But I think this next frontier isn't in the soil, but I think it's really in the story. What Ali is building at Noble West reminds us that storytelling might be the most powerful form of sustainability we have. It keeps communities connected, values credibly visible, and farmers seen. In a world where food is commoditized and is blurred the line between your grower and your consumer, the farms that will last a lifetime will be the ones that make people feel the connection again. And that connection is so important. Not with buzzwords, but with honesty. With stories that show how food is grown and why that still matters. Thanks for listening to The Capitalist Hippie. If this episode stayed with you, share it with someone who cares about where their food and their future comes from.